Macau. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. We will be having a presentation from Dr. Nomonde Fundu, introduction of the new PMTCT. Always a very difficult application to use. Policy and guidelines. This is a follow-up, as you will recall, to our discussions last week. And in our own view then, we had thought we needed to revisit in a more detailed way the submission there that we had last time. And we shall then be having a particular presentation from Dr. Fundu. And once again, thank you very much, Dr. Fundu, for your presence today. We shall then hand over to you to make your submission, and then take it from there. Welcome, members. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair, and good morning, honorable members. This is indeed a continuation of last week's meeting, where the committee had asked the department to come and give a brief overview. At that point, the brief had been to be, well, the brief that the department had received was that it was over the guidelines of PMTCT. And at the committee meeting last week, then the committee made it clear that what they really wanted to know within those guidelines, what they wanted to engage with, was dual therapy. And I think maybe, I don't know if my understanding is correct, Chair, that you do now want the PMTCT guidelines, a complete presentation on the PMTCT guidelines, or you still just want the dual therapy aspect of that. However, as I said, Dr. Kundu will just give a brief overview of the guidelines and then go zero in on the dual therapy, which was of utmost interest to the committee. The relevant document is the document that was circulated last week, that is the document with the details of the guidelines themselves and the treatment therapy itself. But the overview will still cover elements of that, and we can use this, the documents that have been circulated now for as a reference to follow the presentation. Thanks, Chair.
No, thank you. I think that's our interest. Our interest is PMTCT as it progressed to include dual therapy. So it's not just a singular dual therapy, it's a progression of it. I think that was what was lacking last time in terms of understanding that movement, etc. And I'm hoping that's what is going to help us today. Thank you very much, Ms. Masao, Dr. Kungu.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to members of the committee and the colleagues from the TAC. Indeed, I'm going to be talking to the introduction of new PMTCT policy and guidelines building on what the approaches that we've been using previously or on the same program. Mrs. Matao did indicate that copies of this policy and guideline have been circulated at the last meeting. But I want to also indicate as well that the policy document is available on the departmental website. That's the outline to the presentation. I'll go through the purpose as discussed, the guideline in brief, the approach to implementation, which in our view perhaps would be the most important part of this discussion, and some conclusions will be made with a specific recommendation. This is basically to provide information as requested for a discussion and to some degree perhaps advice. What do the guidelines actually say and the processes of the development of this policy and guideline? Where we are with it now, we have a document, as I say, in the departmental website that has been approved or was approved by the Minister on the 12th of February 2008, and the policy approach addresses four stages of intervention, and it carries forward what we've been doing previously with PMTCT, specifically addressing the question of primary prevention of HIV, especially amongst women of childbearing age, which in our view we see as the most sustainable and effective approach to reducing HIV infections in children. Then we have activities that deal with antenatal care aspect of pregnancy, activities during labor and delivery in the process, but also activities related to postnatal care, especially those regarding safe infant feeding. What we stress in the guideline is the importance of any booking of pregnant women, which involves a lot of social mobilization, community mobilization for people to present, for pregnant women to present early in primary healthcare facilities so that they can be offered a package that includes VCT and other antenatal care services. That's part of the policy aspect of what we're going ahead doing. Routine offer of HIV testing is part of this particular package. And if you looked at that document, I'm hoping people did find time to do so before they got to the meeting. The approach and the algorithm is outlined in that document. The additional aspect to this going forward is the repeat test at 34 weeks of those that were previously found to be HIV negative during the initial test. It's done at 34 weeks to allow for 4 weeks of exposure to AZT, which you would need for that particular drug to be effective in reducing HIV transmission risk in this particular context. Counseling on safe infant feeding. People will be hearing a lot now about what is called, in brief, AFAS, which is basically means affordable, feasible, acceptable, safe, sustainable criteria that are emphasized during counseling for safe infant feeding. This is an area that we struggled to put policy around because of inconclusive scientific evidence. But the reality of the South African situation is that most of the women, in fact, who utilize public health care facilities are those that are also have poor access to clean water, to energy, to all of these things, to be able to implement replacement feeding through a formula. So these criteria now are stressed in this policy, particularly during counseling for safe infant feeding practices. What we find because of that is that these babies often die from malnutrition because women don't understand how to mix the feeds, but also they will die from diarrhea-related infections because of poor access to basic services like clean water, energy, and so on. So that particular aspect of safe infant feeding is stressed in this policy going forward. What then about the ARV aspect of this policy? What is recommended there is dual therapy indeed. What it is an addition of AZT to the currently used single-dose nevirapine for PMTCT. What the policy suggests is that AZT should be started at 28 weeks pregnancy or as soon as possible thereafter, but before the onset of labor for it to be effective. For those women who were started on AZT at the correct time, it should then continue during labor, but also add to that. So we'll continue to use single-dose nevirapine. Add to that single-dose nevirapine at labor. What the baby then gets is single-dose nevirapine and AZT, again, dual therapy to the infant, for 7 days if the mother did get the adequate dose, that is the 4 weeks of AZT. If the mother then presented late and didn't get enough AZT to be able to have a drug that will reduce viral load and therefore transmission, the baby then should be considered for a 28-day course of AZT. So those women who got AZT after 34 weeks, their babies then are given AZT for 28 days rather than 7 days. important during this particular period is to make sure that both the mother and the baby do get the drug that is called cotrimoxazole, a affordable, very available drug in primary healthcare facilities that is used to manage opportunistic infections, to reduce the risk of opportunistic infections. So it should be given to all pregnant women who are HIV positive according to the guidelines. But most importantly, these babies have to be given a bactrim, otherwise it's called bactrim, but the correct name for it is called cotrimoxazole. Nutrition interventions form an important element of this particular guideline. We have heard from scientific evidence that nursing mothers that are HIV positive, most of them in the African region, die from malnutrition. And we need to make sure as we implement this policy, indicating or expressing that most of these women, because of the alphas that I discussed earlier, will prefer to breastfeed, to exclusively breastfeed their babies. They need, therefore, to be supported nutritionally. And other social security interventions, and here we stress the importance of registration, referral for grants, and other social safety network interventions during the process. Another important element, which in fact came with the implementation of the comprehensive plan, is to make sure that there's adequate access to CD4 count testing for HIV positive pregnant women. Most importantly here is the identification of those women who are, according to the current guidelines, eligible for antiretroviral therapy for their own disease, which we know would then be useful in reducing the risk of transmission of HIV to their infants. So all of those women who are tested for on CD4 and found to have a CD4 count of equal to and below 200, or otherwise WHO clinical stage 4, will then be referred to those comprehensive plan facilities and be put in front, so to speak, in front of the queue to make sure that they have access to ARVs for their own treatment, but also then in that case reducing the risk of transmission. And we're saying the prioritization of pregnant women at service points. We are in discussion with provinces to consider using or providing this particular intervention, ART, at the obstetric and gynecological units in the hospitals. What you're finding currently in hospitals, these pregnant women have to be referred to the site where the provision of ART is happening, which is far from where they'll be accessing services for their pregnancy and other related issues. So we're encouraging these hospitals and provinces to make sure that the health providers at these ONG units are trained to provide ART for pregnant women who are eligible for that particular intervention. We stress, as previously, this is one aspect that we're carrying forward, safe obstetric procedures. People may remember that this means you need to avoid what is called invasive procedures when women have low immune statuses, because it increases the risk again of exposure to fluids and complications of sepsis and infection and so on. So this should be avoided by all means for pregnant women who are HIV positive. Safe obstetric practices or procedures. Intensive infant feeding education and support, even as we say that we have challenges of inconclusive evidence regarding this, alpha criteria would need to be stressed as we encourage or counsel women to choose the manner in which they'll be feeding their babies, especially HIV positive women. Early testing is another new element that came with a comprehensive plan that will, with the introduction of this policy, be strengthened, is the early testing. People might well be aware, we are now mainly testing using antibody tests at 15 to 18 months. That has posed a lot of problems because we're not quite sure how many of these infections we have now prevented because of poor follow-up, women not coming back at 15 or 18 months because there's no particular visit that is linked to general child care at that point. So with the introduction of PCR to the comprehensive plan, the testing can be done much earlier, at 6 weeks, during the first visit for immunization. Together with that then, that PCR test, the first one, will be done. There's a whole algorithm that relates to PCR testing, depending on the manner of feeding of the baby, whether it's breast or formula and so on. And that is outlined in the guideline itself. Another important element is data management and reporting. This is a systemic problem that we have, and we will try through the introduction of the policy to strengthen that particular aspect. And we've spoken to some of our partners through the Global Fund we have in the National Department of Health now, strengthening district-based surveillance and monitoring of programs by the employment of district-based M&E and data capturers. And they'll be assisting us with that particular aspect. So therefore, a chairperson and members of committee, the major developments in this guideline relate to, as I say, the addition of AZT to single-dose nevirapine. Again, the strengthening of the infant feeding policy. What are some of the implications, therefore? It is a longer course of therapy. Obviously, if it gets started at 28 weeks versus the single dose nevirapine that gets given at labor, that longer course therapy has got implications for the health system. It requires more complex health system support in terms of drug procurement, information management, the additional counseling that needs to happen, and all of those things, health systems related aspects. Drug adherence support is critical for the realization of the health outcomes, and I'm happy to see friends from the TAC here. Perhaps they'll be assisting us with community-based activities regarding drug adherence. Especially here, support for safe infant feeding practices. People struggle in families and homes to adhere to either exclusive replacement or exclusive breastfeeding. And we all know that the most dangerous or the most risky way of feeding is mixed feeding. If you mix breast with water, for that matter, you're increasing the risk of transmission because of what happens internally in the organs of the small infant who is not strong enough to prevent infection. So it has to be exclusively breast or exclusively formula. And those are not the regular ways in which infant feeding has been practiced in communities. So people would need to be supported in their family to be able to do one or the other exclusively. Expected improvement in efficacy is one of the positive implications of the introduction of this policy. In clinical trials, dual therapy is expected to reduce transmission rates from the estimated 30% by about 90%. And we know that also in clinical trials, nevirapine has been thought to reduce transmission by about 50%. So we're not quite sure whether in the program situation we'll realize the same benefit from this intervention, but there is evidence to support this. Reduction in the risk of resistance development. There's been a lot of debate around how best then to reduce the risk of resistance development. An issue, in fact, that was raised by the Department of Health during the introduction of single-dose nevirapine, which has developed to a point now where researchers are indicating or suggesting that it may be 6 months after the institution of single-dose nevirapine, you could consider using nevirapine for the treatment of the mother and the baby, and it would be as effective as in people who have never used single-dose nevirapine, but not earlier than 6 months before that. But also, if you add another drug to nevirapine, you reduce the risk of resistance development. And this is what we're hoping to find from this particular policy. And we had said to ourselves when we put together the M&E and evaluation component of and research component of this policy, to say to the National Health Laboratory Services, specifically the NICD, Institute of Communicable Diseases, they must assist us with resistance surveillance in the PMTCT program. And we'll be working on a program for that. What are some of the challenges that we expect? Most of these will relate to questions of access. This being a more complex sort of program than the single dose Nevada team, we don't expect every clinic to be ready straight away to implement it in the same manner that the current single dose Nevada team program is. It's more complex, it requires a system that will support it. So we need to discuss the questions of access, it's got implications. Monitoring, I've spoken to. The question of budgets, obviously, is going to cost more to implement this more complex programs, and we have costed the program. We have had discussions in the department as to how best then to deal with the challenges around the question of budgets. Communication is going to be key. Communication is going to be key as to how we manage both communication on the protocol itself, but also questions of access and how to utilize adherence and so on, but I'll come back to that point. Approach to implementation. What are we then saying we should actually be introducing this policy? Considerations for readiness to provide, and this is discussions with the implementing agencies, and in our case, it's the provinces that will be implementing this guideline. We had a lot of discussion with provinces and with district managers for that matter, where these facilities are. And they are saying to us, perhaps national should consider that these are some of the things that need to be in place for a facility to be able to provide this service. Obviously, there needs to be a facility manager who makes sure that the system is prepared according to what is expected. There has to be a trained team on the site that is being considered. There has to be adequate physical space so that people are not tested outside in the air like we saw in the city press over the weekend. Other relevant services so that you efficiently utilize the services that are already there. ANs, antenatal care services, family planning services, basic HIV and AIDS services would need to be in place in these facilities for efficient utilization of the system and services, so to speak, but also working towards integration of services at primary and district health level. A reasonable access to laboratory services, I'll outline some of those activities, mainly relating to hemoglobin monitoring, relating to PCR testing, relating also to CD4 testing, and the quality assurance around a rapid test for HIV. Efficient information management systems, for the reasons that I've outlined, would be important. Good record of adherence by the facility to drug dispensing standard operating procedures, especially for the management of opportunistic infections and antiretroviral drugs. Those facilities should have that kind of management system in place. Reasonable demand, utilization and supply numbers of the current PMTs. You don't want to put it where it's not going to be utilized. You want to put it where there's high demand for efficient utilization of the service to maximize access and efficiency. Patient tracking system to be in place for reasons that perhaps are obvious. Efficient links with the district and province for referral systems, but not only referring to the formal health system, referring also to community-based activities. We talked about support for infant feeding, we talked about support to drug adherence. The following health facilities may therefore be considered for the introductory phase of this guideline. So we said perhaps where we currently are implementing the comprehensive plan, most of these elements are in place. Perhaps where it's not CCMT, there's no comprehensive plan, but there is an obstetric and gynecological unit that provides antenatal care services. Laboratory systems will be in place. Information management systems should be in place. And there should be a manager. And all of these things should be in place in that facility. Community health centers with maternal and obstetric units and established comprehensive HIV and AIDS and maternal and child programs in community health centers. And perhaps even at a lower level, other primary healthcare facilities that fulfill the criteria that have been outlined. This is what we suggested and agreed with provinces to consider to get the program started. We think that a district-based approach would be critical. For this program to work, it has to be driven by the district manager, who then will be doing mapping of the current PMTCT services in each sub-district. Identify facilities for implementation of the full package of the new PMTCT guideline. Amongst those, which one will be able to then implement this a new additional element of the PMTCT guideline. Whilst doing that, establish an effective referral system in each sub-district in a manner that is going to make sure there's seamless information management so that we can track who has been registered, who has been started on AZT, what hemoglobin have they been started on, and so on. Identify elements of the different levels with minimal negative impact on access. If in a sub-district, the current PMTCT program is implemented in all primary healthcare facilities, but not all of them will be able to implement the new policy. What are some of the elements that can be done in one facility and others in those that can be implementing a more sort of complex program? So that's the kind of approach that these district managers would need to take in terms of developing a sub-district, what we call sub-district complexes. They may say, for instance, a CHC with about 10 clinics around it can form a complex to implement the program, where different elements, such as primary health, more smaller clinics, are implemented, but the referral system is efficient and effective to such an extent that people will get easy access to a prescription for AZT, for instance, and I'm aware that there'll be debate around that. If I may just move on. Stage two, to that particular aspect about handling medicine. This is an issue that arises out of this policy that perhaps may not have been so critical or important with single-dose nevirapine. Now we're talking about at least four weeks of AZT, a drug which is Schedule 4. All of the ARVs are Schedule 4 drugs. Now, if you look at the regulatory frameworks that support handling of such drugs, what it says is that it requires a prescription by a doctor. And this is specifically coming out of the Medicine Act. We looked around for supportive legislation to see how can this support legislation support us to ensure that this policy doesn't affect access to this particular service. And we saw that the Medicine Act 1978 may, to some degree, be supportive, but there are conditions to the invoking that particular act. What it says in brief is that handling of medicines by nurses, and that part, the specific section is section 38A, nurses can also examine, diagnose illness or defect, and importantly here is the monitoring of hemoglobin, which is an indication of the complications of anemia commonly associated with AZT, and we need to make sure we monitor that hemoglobin. A common cause of death amongst pregnant women, maternal death is anemia related. And if you introduce AZT into that kind of background, you need to make sure that your systems are in place to monitor that women don't die from anemia. Again, that acts to some degree, that provides support for nurses to be considered in particular conditions. But what it says is this should be authorized either by the Director General of the Department of Health, the Head of Health in provinces, the Medical Officer of Health in local authorities, the Medical Officer of an organization that has been designated to provide the service, designated by the DG to do so, in consultation with the Nursing Council. Only, and this is important, only whenever the services of a medical practitioner or pharmacist are not available. We're talking Schedule 4 drugs, and this is the regulatory framework that supports the use of those. And adherence also to these particular other regulations relating to handling of drugs is important.
That's why I think.
So,
yes, indeed, Chair, thanks, Dr. Rabinovich. If I may then continue, some of the elements that we thought perhaps could be considered for smaller clinics so that there's continuity of service, efficient utilization of the system in a sub-district sort of complex that is managed by the district manager is obviously they can continue to offer a routinely VCT. Infant feeding counseling can continue to happen at the primary health care, at the TMTC services. CG4 testing can also continue to happen. TB screening, nutrition support, the other social support, PCR testing, and hemoglobin monitoring can continue to happen at this, smaller clinic. Larger centers may, with easy access to a doctor, should be considered for the prescription of dual therapy. Specifically in this case, the prescription of ACE and TB. Clients may be referred to the centers for the original prescription. AZT should then be delivered on a patient name basis down to where they would easily get access to the clinic to get a continuation of AZT. It has been done with some of the management of some of the programs, drugs being sent down to clinic on a patient name basis, and we've had discussions with pharmaceutical services, and this is possible to do. We may, in some cases, consider invoking the regulatory provisions in order to increase access, especially as outlined, as provided for in these specific regulations. But as we do all of these things, quality assurance would be critical. I've mentioned some of the important laboratory services. The importance of monitoring hemoglobin cannot be overstated. Currently, it's done by the nurses using a handheld service, a handheld device at the point of care at the clinics themselves. There may be instances where blood would need to be taken to the laboratory, and those are outlined in the policy, which ones would need to go to the lab, which ones can be safely done at the clinic itself. Quality assurance around VCT testing is one important laboratory-based service. I've mentioned CD4, viral load, and PCR turnaround times. We're in discussion with the National Health Laboratory Services to make this service as efficient and quality assured as possible. I mentioned earlier the importance of resistance surveillance, and there will be a program to monitor resistance, working with the NICD in this regard. There is obviously opportunity, particularly around this, to improve technology for better efficiency, especially in remote areas. We've seen the use of cell phones, which are very widely accessible these days, to make sure we get easy access to results from the laboratory, and we can remind people to come and collect their medicines and so on. So there's opportunity to improve the efficient use of technology that's available. We have identified in the policy some core indicators. In the old guideline, we are reporting only on 7 indicators that relate to TMTCT. They have now been expanded to about 22, but we're saying for a start, we'll start with the core indicators and the 13 of them, and they are outlined in the guideline itself. And the way the flow of information will go is obviously from the facility to the district, to the province, to NASAL, and then with feedback to all of those who need information, which is basically everyone in the system and the public service users and so on, to be expanded after 12 months to cover the other elements, the data elements. Operational research that we're considering to do during the implementation of this guideline, it could cover areas of awareness and knowledge, uptake, health systems issues, that relate mainly to quality and access, and obviously then the outcomes, the transmission rates and so on. I did mention earlier the question of resistance surveillance. It, all of this information management and research will be part of the training program. And communication mainly to the provincial ex-cos, and this has started already. in two of the provinces, we have communicated to the executives about the policy and the manner in which we recommend it should be implemented. Provincial councils on AIDS are currently being briefed on the policy, as well as the district AIDS councils, the general public, by ourselves and the provinces. Provinces will basically be communicating how they plan to implement their own their programs within their own health system. Obviously, then we'll be using the usual vehicles for communication. What are we going to be communicating is the package, is the importance of primary HIV prevention, which can never be overstated, rather. Early ANC booking, benefits of VCT, the involvement of male and partners, community support, safe infant feeding, adherence and support. Those are some of the communication messages that we're busy developing around this policy. How are we approaching training? We said there should be a trained team in each of the facilities. We are currently updating the PMCCT, the current manual, to cover the additional elements of the new policy. And we envisage a situation where the manual will be printed by the 25th of March. We should be done by that. But the plan is to start training. Training starts on the 31st of March. Short-term in-service is the approach to it. We think that it will be a 7-day course covering those areas that are outlined there. Counseling, hemoglobin monitoring, the drug toxicities, the dual therapy, PCR, safe infant feeding, nutrition for the mother, program monitoring as I indicated, and other relevant aspects. The approach that we're taking, again, is to train a critical mass of about 10 master trainers and course directors in each province, whom then will cascade the training down to in that particular province. And this master trainer program will be covered over a week or 3-week period in April. And we're targeting to train facility managers, hospital CEOs, all participating staff and support staff, district managers and local health municipality services. Health service providers are to be trained by mid-May in all 9 provinces. We're starting training on the 31st of March. By mid-May, we should have master trainers in all of the provinces. And we'll be working with nursing institutions, pre-training services to assist us with that particular aspect, doctor training, nurse training, and so on. The National Department of Health is currently busy with the printing of the guideline for distribution. We will be providing a support to provinces. Physically, we'll be going on a monthly basis to make sure that the program does get off the ground and is supported. We will implement the training program as the National Department of Health ourselves, assisted also in supporting provinces. We'll be doing quarterly progress review meetings with the provinces as implementing agencies. We will be updating the DHIS, in fact that has been started already, to add the other elements of the PMTCT, increasing them from 7 to 13, as well as making sure that the conditional grant does cover the monitoring of the new PMTCT guideline as we advocate for funding of this policy. The estimated costs, as you will find them, in fact, during the costing of the National Strategic Plan, is as outlined in the slide. Just to indicate that the in red is what the Department of Health will be going to ask for from the National Treasury for additional resources for the PMTCT program. It increases basically from about 4% of the whole HIV and AIDS budget to about 11%. And we are negotiating with, as I say, with National Treasury to assist us with that funding. But within this current financial year, in other words, in the next 5 to 6 weeks, what are the things that we can do or should do and the resource implications thereof. As I say, it's splitting and distribution, it's the training, it's meeting with the stakeholders on communication, and these budgets are currently available in the Department of Health, and we'll be getting on with that kind of work. And provinces are currently busy putting together their district-based provincial plans of the sub-district complexes, and these will be submitted soon to the National Department of Health, to the DG and the National Department of Health. In there, what we're expecting to find is identification of the service points, but also some kind of indication of practically when these can be seen to be taking off in all of the different provinces. We've had discussions with the head of health in all of the departments, in the government departments, in the departments of health in provinces, but we've also had extensive discussions with the program managers for the HIV and AIDS programs in provinces, as well as PMCCC coordinators. As part of progress, as I say, head of health are aware of what needs to be done, what is in the policy and the expectations from them, as well as their managers, as I say. The National Health Council has been briefed, and what we got from that council is commitment to support implementation of policy and guidelines. What also came out of that briefing from National Health Council is that local municipalities are actually quite keen to contribute, and these will be discussed as to how best to make efficient utilization of health services from that level. In conclusion, Chairperson, the new policy and guidelines from TMCC have been approved, and I have outlined where we move from and where we move to, and what the major differences from the old to the new policy are. I hope that I have outlined adequately then the approach to the introduction of this new policy. The national operational plan will be, as soon as we get these provincial plans, as I say, district-based, sub-district complexes, we'll put together then a national plan out of those, a bottom-up kind of approach to it. National Health Laboratory Services is aware of how they would need to support the program. National Department of Health is to ensure allocation of budget, and these are the discussions that are currently underway, but the rest of the financial year and the activities of this current financial year are covered by budget, and we are negotiating then the additional resources moving from 4 to 11% of the PMCCC element of the HIV and AIDS budget. Monitoring and evaluation is going to be critical. Pharmacovigilance, toxicities from drugs and so on would need to be strengthened and monitored. The question of resistance surveillance, as well as we need to conclude evaluating the current PMCCC program. We are recommending, therefore, that the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Health takes note of progress towards implementation of the new PMCCC policy and guidelines, and we are asking for support for successful implementation of this policy and guidelines. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Kondo. Welcome to the DG. You came late, as you know, that you was also busy with the NCOP budget process. He may leave at any time, I think, for other engagements. So if he leaves, you must also be aware that an apology has been tendered with the chairperson. Honourable members, that's the presentation. Will that be right, Sandy, to say it's a good presentation? Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I guess you have met the expectations. May I therefore allow the... I'm sorry, I say Sandy, Honourable Kalyan. My sincere apologies. that's the presentation. Can we allow questions, comments? Thank you very much, Honorable Dudley.
First one that came to mind, excellent presentation that sort of guided us very nicely through. When you speak about the referral system, obviously we know that's where we have a lot of problems because there's no transport. And if you could just explain to us what sort of transport arrangements have been put in place with regard to that system. And then what I'm not too clear about is, and I know you've just spoken about it, and it's just the present budget, how the present budget is covering this. If you could just explain that once again. And then obviously the important things like monitoring, evaluation being essential, and all of the other aspects really, in terms of the capacity issues that we've had up to now, where are we and what is immediately happening at this moment in terms of making sure that we've got the capacity person-wise to deal with? You know, are we bringing in a sudden influx of doctors or nurses from somewhere? Just give us a little clearer picture on those issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I'd like to compliment the presenter on a very good presentation. It's very thorough. I do have some questions. My first one is, how can guidelines be approved and yet the necessary infrastructure is not in place? Because that's what I pick up from your presentation. Following on from that, what is the total number of hospitals and primary health care centers countrywide, and how many of these are your CCMTs? In other words, I'd like to know, in KwaZulu-Natal, which is my where I come from, in my constituency, which hospital is a CCMT and is the service available? I'd like to have a breakdown province-wide. And then I'll hold you back on all of the 50 questions that I have here, but I'd like to talk to the budget. In your budget, you talk about what's given from Treasury, but we know full well that outside funding is available also for implementation of PMTCT. I got it right. Okay. Now, where does donor funding fit in here, and how is it utilized?
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, maybe one need to echo the same sentiments of my colleagues from both ACDP and the DA, that indeed the presentation has been good and very much informative. Chairperson, my question will be closely related to NSCs, because I think you cannot actually divorce the issues of PMTCT from the new strategic plan on HIV and AIDS. I just want to know as to whether structures has been anticipated by the NSC are in place. For instance, all the structures from the province until to the local municipalities are in place. And the other issue that I want to ask is around conditional grants, because when the Minister Trevor Manuel speaks of conditional grants, solely he's referring those grants to HIV and AIDS and other issues relating to the men. I just want to know as to whether the department will make it quick for all the provinces to provide the department with business plans in place, business plans in time. And lastly, Chairperson, I just want to know, because this is a recommended policy guideline, will it provide adequate access to doctors, pharmacy assistants, and community health workers? Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the encouraging comments from the honourable members of committee. The question from Honourable Dudley around transport arrangement and what has been done on that. Honourable member of committee, you won't find that kind of infrastructural and systemic intervention in a protocol kind of document, even though there is a sense of understanding of all of those challenges given the implementation of previous programs in the district health system, what we are saying is, as the provinces being implementing agencies themselves and working closely with district managers, all of those issues that relate to infrastructure and transport issues will then be addressed as they develop these sub-district complexes. Obviously, transport will come into the equation of access and referral systems. And at that level, then the detail of how transport is going to be working at the provision of service will come out. This is rather a higher level, sort of national level policy guideline of what would need to be done, which does, in fact, consider that. At a point where the provinces have submitted their provincial plans, perhaps at that point then we'll have an understanding of how that particular aspect of access will work. Present budget, and if I may just combine the budget related questions that are coming from the three honourable members that you have asked, is I did indicate in one of the slides that in the rest of the current financial year, we do have provision in terms of budgets in relation to activities that we see done. And most of them are printing and training and holding this meeting with stakeholders, communication and so on. What is being discussed currently, and there is reason to be optimistic about the provision of the additional 7% from the conditional grant to ensure the implementation, starting in fact from the first 6 months of the next financial year up to the point then where we go back to Treasury during the budget process to make sure that we cover the rest of the MTF period, so to speak. And in relation to that, there's a question of what about the donor funding? We do encourage private and not-for-profit organizations that do qualify according to criteria to provide the service. Some of them, indeed supported by different donor agencies, will provide PMTCT elements. And provinces are then monitoring quality issues, reporting issues, alignment to standard treatment guidelines, and making sure that there's interface and working together with those donor agencies where there is greatest need. But what we need to manage tightly around that is to ensure that we channel that additional resource to an identified gap to minimize overlap and also to maximize additionality, so to speak. So it's channeling that additional funding at provincial level to an identified gap. It's not just an open kind of free-for-all sort of approach to it. A related matter, Honorable Matsumela, is the conditional grant business plans. I did outline in the slides that the DG will be getting business plans that are specific for this particular guideline by the 14th of March. And this already has been discussed with the heads of health, and I'm aware that my colleagues, program managers in provinces, are frantically working, putting together their business plan together to submit as agreed, both by the Technical Committee of the National Health Council. But linked to that is the broader conditional grant business plan that will then include this expanded dual therapy program to PMTCT. I think if I may, Chair, also respond to the correct indication by Honorable Matsumela on the NSP and location of this particular guideline within the NSP. Members of committee may be reminded that Section 12 of the NSP in fact speaks to the responsibility of government to develop the policies to make sure that we maximize, in this particular case, efficacy of reduction of transmission from mothers to babies. This is one of the things that the Department of Health has done to meet that requirement of Section 12 of the National Strategic Plan, developing and approving this particular policy. As to whether the structures are in place in terms of the councils, provincial AIDS councils are, in most cases, we did a provincial roadshow in November, December last year. And part of the things that we were looking for is how functional these structures that Honorable Matsimela is referring to are. And in most cases, I would say in about 70% or so of the provinces, provincial aid councils are functional, led in most cases by the premier. There are provinces, I know in the Western Cape, for instance, that the MEC for Health is leading the provincial aid council here for various reasons. There's variability and flexibility around that, as long as you realize the output and what needs to be done. Perhaps, and I think when you go around as well, in local municipalities, most of them do have local AIDS councils, and in their local IDPs, they mainstream HIV and AIDS, and the representation of SAIGA at National Health Council has been quite useful, where you hear the keenness from local municipalities to contribute in whatever way possible to the implementation of the policies. So there's room to improve the efficiency of the structures, but in most cases, there is keenness to participate and contribute. There is a chair, if I may, the question is specifically relating to the province of KZN about facilities. I have to say to Honorable that I don't have that view that knows the detail of the province. I have a broader sort of a national view. And I know, Gigi, if you want to assist me with the total number of facilities and so on, but what I can indicate is that up to now, there is at least about 380 or so CCMT facilities nationwide. I'm not too sure, Honorable, how many of those are from KZN specifically, but that's the broad number of CCMT facilities. I'll stop there.
There was a perhaps on the hospitals, we maybe at a later stage agree that we be given the breakdown if it's not available now. There was a question from Honorable Dudley on monitoring and evaluation in terms of our capacity. Where are we, and as well as the personnel capacity?
Sir, thank you very much. There's one question that perhaps Dr. Kundu hasn't really dealt with, which is from the Honorable Member about how can guidelines be approved and there is no infrastructure for that purpose. Well, first of all, for infrastructure to be developed, you have to have the legislative and regulatory tools. In other words, you wouldn't go to provinces and say, develop this, prepare budgets for this, because we're about to declare it in 12 months' time. They will not necessarily do that, because it's not something that is in law, that is policy. So you will find that in general, you develop policy and agree on it first, but you have assessed the extent to which it will actually require the development of infrastructure, which is why we tend to say, now here's the policy, what is the implementation plan for it? And this particular one, we've looked at that and are trying to fast-track implementation, even though there's a whole range of infrastructural issues that would still come. But that's the normal course of events, because actually we can't say to a province that you need to develop this, that, and the other, because we don't have that authority, because it's not policy, it's not regulation, we're just thinking about it. So you have to have the regulatory framework decided upon so that the province can actually implement that. Otherwise, they wouldn't. I mean, it would be just a wish. So that's the normal course of events with regard to that. Now, in relation to the broader issues of capacity, I think we must think in broad terms about the fact that the system has a challenge of capacity, human resource capacity, and therefore all the HR strategies that we are employing in order to deal with that, including recruitment of foreign health professionals, prioritizes some of these areas that we need immediate intervention in. We have a whole range of mechanisms which we have discussed before in this committee that are attempting to deal with the challenges of human resource capacity, including issues such as improving the remuneration and the conditions of employment, recruitment of foreign professionals, opening more opportunities for training in relation to these professionals. So in the broader sense of how we're dealing with the human resource challenges, we would want to actually see this program that way. But in particular with regard to such programs where there's such sensitivity, we are also engaging the professionals who are in the private sector to be able to have that partnership with us so that we can, for example, ensure that where there's no pharmacist, but there are pharmacists that are in private practice, they are able to support the programs in the public sector. There are issues that we're discussing with them in relation to how we pay for their services, etc., etc. But that partnership is actually something that we have established. So all those issues with regard to human resource capacity, we're exploring all sorts of possible ways of dealing with that challenge, even in the context of rural areas where there are challenges, they are much more pronounced. But also in relation to that, you'll see that one of the issues that was raised was the use of other health professionals, particularly nurses, for purposes of ensuring that they are given the authority to do the diagnosis and prescription. And that of course, with the training that is that should accompany that. And I should say, Chairperson, that although we're talking about the Nursing Act of 1978, the amendment that this committee and this parliament passed has not yet been promulgated. But once it's promulgated, it added an element of training in it. It didn't take away that responsibility. So we're only referring to it here because that's the law of the land at the moment. But otherwise, there has been an amendment which we are aware of, and once it's promulgated, then we'll be able to refer to it directly in terms of its applicability here. But it doesn't change much from what is in the 1978 Act. What it adds is with that exact issue of trade. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Your
question has not been adequately responded. You may come back at a later stage. Honorable Andrew Mandela.
Thank you, Chair. I also wish to add my appreciation for this excellent presentation, Chair. My concern or questions relate more with the practicalities. The presentation doesn't really speak to the time frames. When will this be implemented? Chair, when can we at the service points access gene therapy? Okay, that is the important thing. And then, of course, Chair, the Western Cape, we do know, I mean, this is your and my province, that this province have been engaged in the provision of gene therapy. To what extent has what they have done brought in line with the national guidelines, Chairperson? I think that is the third question. Chair, I must say, and I hope my province will forgive me for asking this question. The proposed PMTCT-MTS budget, one finds it a little bit somehow strange that if one looks at the figures, the Western case figures are indeed the highest, yet our HIV prevalence levels are among the lowest in the country. So one is wondering what's happening there. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Mukunda, I would say that this is a fantastic ideal, and like much of our AIDS policy, the ideal is to serve. But as we're all hearing, the reality is a long way from the ideal. And I wonder if you really believe that this can happen with the current structure of our health services. Because if you do, you're incredibly hopeful and positive. And if you don't, then this could be a facade. And I'm just putting that forward as a thought, but I hope it isn't so. Now my question, on what research is the 50-90% based?
And have there been protocols in South Africa combining nevirapine and the different forms of feeding, like breast and either total breast or total bottle feeding, or nevirapine and AZT with either total breast or total bottle feeding? And that brings me to the next question. Our district health systems were supposed to be up and running so that we could give certificates of need to people, a huge bureaucratic intervention. But are they up and running so that you can give us figures right now at the ready and say how many pregnant women are being seen in clinics and hospitals? How many pregnant women are receiving nevirapine? How many babies have been born? How many have HIV? How many have been monitored? How many have been checked? The point I'm making is, do we have a database to give these figures immediately? The experience of many of us is that you have to ask questions of the department over and over again, and when you get the answers, you don't get them quickly. So if our information systems are so weak currently, how are we going to provide for this complicated surveillance? And that leads me to the other question, why have such a complex feedback system? National to provincial to local, back to local to provincial, back to national. That is just going to add more bureaucratic obstacles, which brings me to the next point. Somebody asked a question about the involvement of international donors, and I would like to ask the question of mobile units. I've myself been involved for nearly 4 years now trying to help private donors get mobile units to serve people in KwaZulu-Natal with an AIDS program. And because of all this need to find out where's the gap and who needs it most and how we're not going to duplicate services, we're still sitting without a service. So the intentions don't match up with the reality. And that knocks the heart and soul out of many people who've worked in this department. It obviously hasn't done that to you. But I'd just like to know how you're going to cope with some of those problems. I've got many more questions, but I'm sure the chair will ask me to keep quiet. So I'll come back in the next round.
You know, don't go to the group.
Thank you, Chairperson. My questions were more related to time frames, because when I looked at the training program and the way how tight it was, I just wanted to wonder how effective it was going to be and who, at which level was it directed, because it's just training. I don't know the level to relate it to the number of days and the content in relation to the specific group of people to be trained. And the mobile unit is now covered by Dr. Radinovich, because I was just going to ask if they were going to be used in remote areas and the control of medicines and other essential drugs that might be of priority. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Thank you, Dr. Kung, for the presentation. So my concern is around the issue of pregnant mothers that does not know their status, that did not test on their antenatal clinic visit. Are we going to see HIV testing become compulsory during this period? And I also want to know whether can we roll AZT or nevirapine to those mothers that did not, to those babies that their mothers did not test for HIV as a preventive measure. Thank
you. Sir, I'd like to start before I ask to be excused and to go back to the other committee. Just by broadly saying, it's critical to the honourable member to remember that we have a system with a constitution which actually explains what the national responsibility will be and what the provincial responsibility will be. If we had a unitary system in the country, the issue of the feedback loops that you're talking about would actually be obviated. But you have certain responsibilities that are attached to provinces by the constitution of our country. And the National Department of Health is responsible for the policy and the norms and standards and monitoring and evaluation. But the actual implementation of this program is the responsibility of the provinces. And therefore, the feedback loops within that would have to be established for that purpose. Because, for example, where we sit, we wouldn't know in Amatikutu what exactly the province has planned unless they give us that information, and then we go back and verify, we do all sorts of things like that. So that's part of the process of the structures that we have because of the constitution of our country as it stands at the moment. So we have to put mechanisms that are reporting upwards and downwards in relation to these matters. Now, also linked to that is the issue which you have alluded to, Honourable Member, of trying to ensure that the system works in an intelligible manner. We have a lot of proposals from all sorts of donors about mobile clinics for various reasons. Yesterday, I had a meeting with people who were introducing mobile clinics for TB and, you know, rapid testing, and therefore they would have them all over the place. But we wouldn't know how to pay them and the sustainability of the issue, because at some point the donors will go away, and we must work on the premise that they will go away, because that's what is happening in the world. If you look at the donor, the direction of where donor funding is going now, you'll find that the donors that were concentrating on certain things have moved. And therefore, you have to be sure that whatever you're introducing, you can sustain yourself in the end. And that's our principle, that as a country, we must be self-sustaining by and large. That's why our program, compared to any other program in the African continent, is by and large largely driven by government, funded by government, because we believe that that's a very critical principle in terms of self-reliance and so on. So I think that issue is also important. That's why we look at gaps, so that we can be able to sustain in future what happens. But if we have duplication, then we discontinue these things when the donors run away, and we have problems because people actually have a certain perception about what has been happening before the donor was here, and now the donor is no longer there. So that's a very critical planning issue for us. Now, with regard to implementation, I think perhaps to re-emphasize what Dr. Kundu was saying, we have passed the policy. We had a discussion with the National Health Council only on Friday last week to say, this is how we see the implementation going. Now you go away as each province and give us a business plan. So we would only be able to know, except we're targeting that, at least in every province, there must be some implementation by May. That's what we say as a national target. For example, the Gauteng province said to us, we've been preparing for this, we've started our training, and we've got so many doctors and nurses that are trained. We've already piloting in 55 of the institutions that we've got. We'll look at it and see whether the criteria. So depending on what the provinces will do, we'll be able to then say after the 14th of March that KwaZulu-Natal says, and in a breakdown, and that we can also provide after we've got the business plans on the 14th of March chair, that this is what has come out of the provinces. They say this is their implementation target. So we'll be able to know in what facility they already have the capacity, and in what other they are trying to establish that capacity, and therefore what time frame it's going to take. At the moment, as we sit, we cannot really give that information, because the provinces now are still to give us the business plans that are supposed to tell us how they intend to implement this program, now having agreed on the program and having agreed on what criteria the facilities are going to use and what needs to be in a facility and how to organize all that infrastructure. So we will know, say, just after the 14th of March, give and take a week, knowing provinces, as Honorable Matsimela, I think, was asking the question on the basis of that. How sure are you that you're going to get this business plan in time, because we have general problems? Give and take a week, because we're actually doing it physically. we will actually know at least what plans are on the table. Now, in relation to the final question, I think it's also a question of do you believe that this thing can be implemented, or is it just the idea? I think in a way we must always be positive about our programs. We have challenges on the ground. We have a lot of challenges, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't have these policies, because then we're robbing those that actually can implement even yesterday the framework for which they can use, and the legal framework that will allow them to implement. So we've got to have the policy so that we allow people to know how to do these things. And it's not simply ideal, because we're implementing it within the context of a program that has been happening already. We couldn't wait simply for the day when we're going to be able to actually have the information systems and know everything that happens there. That would be ideal. And in fact, in a program like this, we would want that ideal to be much more reality. But in the meantime, let's try and see if we can do anything to save the babies that we can actually save, while we look at these infrastructural issues that are big challenges. So our optimism comes from the fact that at least from the evidence that we have in front of us, this is something that can save babies, and let's do that. Let's put infrastructure to monitor, yes, and understand what is happening. But the research, as Dr. Kundu will explain, I think in more detail, suggests that there is something that actually is saving babies, and therefore let's do it. We wouldn't have to wait until we know everything about everything and we've put every infrastructure, because that is actually ideal, because currently we have a challenge in our human resource capacity.
Thank you, Chairperson. The DG has responded to most of the questions. If I may address myself to slide 23, the budget a discussion of perhaps the equitable distribution of the PMTCT element. I have to apologize upfront for specifically the column 2, 8, and 9. Because what we did there, if you look at 207 and 08 column, that is the historical allocation by provinces for their own PMTCT grants. And you may well be aware, honorable members, that Western Cape is already implementing dual therapy. It will therefore be more expensive for that province to implement PMTCT. It may relate somewhat to numbers, but it's likely because they're already implementing a dual therapy. What we did, unfortunately, and as I say, we just used that formula to apply going forward to MTF, and we're busy reviewing that to consider these questions of prevalence and population numbers and systemic requirements and so on. So that is going to change, but we used that 207 and 208 as baseline. But also what we need to consider going forward is that this province, having implemented this policy for the past 3 years or so, therefore shouldn't require infrastructural or inputs in terms of budget as much as other provinces would be. So as the GG is saying, we are waiting for the business plan from the provinces to indicate the elements, the targets, the budget items, and the expected, therefore, amount of money. That was for us a working document. So that province shouldn't really be about 56 million as outlined there. I take that particular point. As to, if I may add to what the DG is saying, the idealism versus reality, I support what Gigi is saying. Look, if we managed as a country to implement the comprehensive plan, I think that members should say we should be able, this is a less complex program than the comprehensive plan with all of the elements. And I think that the comprehensive plan has actually assisted to strengthen the health system to a point where we can say now some of these lesser complex as they are, but to a lesser degree, the programs could be considered, which is why we're taking the approach of saying a bottom-up approach that is informed by the practicalities on the ground in this manner that says sub-district complexes informed by the realities on the ground to say this small clinic can take this particular element of the program, but ensure that the referral system is working. And this is with full understanding of what the challenges are around the questions of transport, information management, and all of that. It's an optimistic view that says within the constraints of the system, this is what perhaps could be considered, informed in this particular way by realities on the ground in a bottom-up approach that informs then the national operational plan, having finalized the policy aspect of that. If I may also add another element to the research question. Evidence that we have that we're currently working on, we know that the use of AZT in PMTCT, there's established evidence internationally. And in this particular case for us, in hindsight now we're saying perhaps we should say it was fine for the Western Cape to do it, because we can go back and say these are now the transmission rates in the Western Cape and you can see the difference. They have been able also to monitor and report on all of these things. So there is evidence in the country on the use of AZT in PMTCT, supported by another world of evidence, African and internationally, for the use of AZT in PMTCT. Where there are problems, though, Chairperson and members of committee, is the question of safety of infant feeding in the context of HIV. There is work that was done in KZN, once again, or where they assessed the transmission rates in the context of a single-dose developing PMTCT program in a rural community. And there were large numbers of women that were involved in that research, above 2,300 or so, that were looked at. And there were three subgroups. The one group was the one that was formula feeding, exclusively formula feeding, and the other two, there was mixed feeding as well as exclusive breastfeeding. What the findings were, even though the group that was strictly formula feeding was small and difficult, therefore, to compare with the others, I think the interesting findings from that case at end, it was led by I can't remember the name of the professor, but what they found was that 80% of those women in KZN in the rural area did actually choose to exclusive breastfeed. But what needed to happen was intensive support for women to be able to exclusively breastfeed in the strictest sense, especially in community-based support in the family, where the mother, the grandmother will ask, why are you not giving water, why are you not giving the other things, why are you not... So you need to have a supportive system for women to practice safe infant feeding. It can be done, that was what that research showed. But in terms of transmission rates then, what the finding was that mixed feeding, especially if it is with solids, is the most dangerous in terms of transmission rates. Then comes mixed feeding with other fluids, with formulas and with water and so on. But exclusive breastfeeding was safer than mixed feeding. Obviously, replacement feeding, there's no HIV there, but that group was too small to compare with the other two. So there is that kind of work. Further work is currently underway to establish the facts around that, which is why we're saying in the policy, the AFAS principle would need to be strictly communicated, but also strengthen support for safe infant feeding, specifically around that. In terms of which drugs to use, dual, single-dose, nevirapine, that work also has been done, as I say, indicated earlier, locally and internationally. I don't know, Chairperson, if there's any other question that the DG has not addressed that I perhaps may attempt to respond to. Or there was a specific question, Chairperson, on the status, unknown, women of unknown HIV status. Are we going to be going in the route of compulsory testing? And the answer there, Chairperson, is categorically no. we feel that women would need to voluntarily take the HIV test because of the implications of the outcomes of that test that they would individually would need to deal with. And with the background stigma that is experienced, you have people killing themselves because they discover they're HIV positive, they are scared that they won't be accepted by society and so on. So we still have a lot of societal stigma that requires for a person to fully understand the decision of taking up an HIV test before they do so, which is why it is important, therefore, that this counseling should continue. Testing can never be compulsory at the moment. What do we then do with babies of women of unknown status? Do we just give AZT as prophylaxis? No. This is not a drug without toxicities and complications. We still don't know what we would be doing in terms of resistance development, which is why we're putting in place surveillance for resistance management. We are also worried about the question of hemoglobin, especially amongst young babies and women. So we can't just, in a blanket kind of approach, give everyone AZT. I'm not sure what the basis of that would be. Perhaps Honorable was thinking about background prevalence, race, and therefore prophylaxis. But I think that the risks would outweigh benefits in that kind of approach. So we'll stick to the protocol. Chairperson, I'll stop there.
The question all answered. I thought Honorable Ngabinde's question was also indicating that firstly that people may not know their status simply because, not necessarily because of the testing aspect itself, but may not be aware in the 28 weeks that at that point in time they are pregnant. And therefore, and then in the process, there are other problems. How then do we actually address that kind of question? I think that's also the aspect of the question you may consider in responding. Honorable Kalyan, I'm sorry, I'm not surprising you, Honorable Whip of the committee. Can I take Honorable Kalyan and then come back to you?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm still not quite happy with the DG's response, where I asked how is it that you can have guidelines and not have the infrastructure in place. I'd like to explain where I'm coming from. Because when you decide on something, you obviously do a needs analysis. When you're coming up with a proposal, you must do a needs analysis. And for me, it would appear that simple things like, for example, which sites, a projection of staffing that was needed was not done. Yet you came up with a guideline and now you're depending on the provinces to do all that work. So for me it's not tying as one following on the other. Also when you're doing your needs analysis, when you're drawing up the guidelines, you're going to say, I'm predicting that I need this kind of facility because you say physical space, storage facility and so on. We are also talking here about almost a specialized unit to run your counseling and your testing and everything. What staff projections are we looking at countrywide? Do we have, you said capacity, we don't have it. Now we're talking about taking nurses away from active duty and training them for 7 days. Okay, and what happens to their duties in the meantime? If we're already short of staff, and you're going to take our people and put them on a 7-day training program, what happens to the other work that is there? With regard to the counseling, we're emphasizing counseling in this entire package. How much time per client are we anticipating? Does a nurse have 30 minutes per client? As a starting point, normally I'm a psychologist, I sit for 1 hour per client, and then too, I'm not satisfied that I've done enough, I say come back. So realistically, again, let's talk about that. It's quite interesting to see the department's turnaround in terms of the delay. You referred DG that we, you know, you're aware that by not rolling out this plan, we are causing, you know, that babies could die, and it's refreshing to see that the attitude you say that we can't wait for everything to be perfect, let's start the rollout and we can say it's quite optimistic. Now, that follows on. If we can't wait for everything to be perfect and in place, but we're going to start a rollout, can somebody explain why the doctor in KwaZulu-Natal who took his initiative from outside donor funding, got the medication, dispensed dual therapy, was suspended from his job? That's the first one. The second one is, can somebody explain why the Ministry for Health in KwaZulu-Natal goes on national radio and says AZT is toxic? We are talking here now, here's a plan, and it's very optimistic. We are talking about dual therapy. Why does it means that NEC hasn't bought into your plan?
Thank you, Chairperson. Probably it's the out of sight, out of mind that you know me, but I'm back and I'm back to this. Most of my questions have been answered that I had in mind, but I would like to ask on page 5, slide 10, bullet 4, on patient treatment tracking system, which is in place. According to you, the system is in place. My question is, 10, bullet 4. If the tracking system is in place, does it mean that at the press of a button, you'll be able to locate a patient who is somewhere in the bundle, whether he's taking his treatment or her treatment, defaulting or whatever? Can it do that? And also, on the transportation of medicines, can you locate fact during transport from point A to point B that there is a problem somewhere there and you quickly act on it? And on page 7, bullet 14, the small clinics. My concern is on small clinics who are now going to be given all these 8 bullets up there, visiting, infant feeding, feeding water, testing, feeding screening, nutrition, blah, 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 will they be able to actually quite rightly say, capacity is the problem. How are you going to deal with it? And can you explain to me, the people sitting around the wall of this room, where do you actually use them in the services of your comprehensive plan, and whether they are stipend like the other service caregivers?
Thank you, Chair. I was just afraid of the fact that the DG might leave without before I ask my questions. And also, forgive me for coming late. I know my principal will be here. All I am saying is that I realize the logic in which the DG answers questions. But my main worry here is that all the policies put in place, the provinces will have to implement, the hospitals will have to implement. But now my question is, how does the National Department of Health go around to see to it that what has been promulgated is actually practiced. Because we have had a lot of shortage of staff, shortage of doctors, shortage of nurses, until in my place, a child pregnant went to the clinic. They told her that there was no midwife and there was no ambulance. She was referred to go to another clinic by taxi. She went. She was told the same. She had to go and wait for a taxi to be full. When they were halfway, the child wanted to come out. And then they put a stone here in order to delay. And then before they could reach the hospital, the child said, no, no, no. It's my time not to get out. That young girl was helped by an untrained youngster, a girl, and a taxi driver. Just because of shortage of nurses, shortage of midwives, and the shortage of transport. Now, how does the department take steps against the province, against the hospitals, and so on? I'm sure the department knows that there is a shortage of ambulances, there is a shortage of nurses, there is a shortage of doctors. What responsibility is the department taking? Thank you.
Thanks. I just needed to return quickly to the issue of transport. Obviously, the ideal would be that the sites would be fully equipped, and the ideal would be that we'd have these mobile units and all that, and hopefully that's going to come. But in the meantime, the reality is, even without what is there, nothing's working in the province. And for any kind of service, people are getting referred, and they can't go because they don't have the means to go. So I'm just anxious that we make the transport issue a really major priority here, whether it's about having a certain number of ambulances or whatever has to be done. But I'm seeing that the guide, it has to somehow come into our guidelines from national, because the fact is if it's not being done already for other services, it's not going to suddenly be done from a provincial point of view here. So if we could just get stress for fact. Thank you.
Sorry if I provoked you, but it's just that a single story can say so much when we're being theoretical. And the questions that I wanted to ask were, does the resistance that develop just in the individual, or does it develop in the community? And what is the percentage of state hospitals that are accredited to provide antiretroviral therapy? And if you think will be accredited to provide this AZT dual therapy? And how does that compare with your target goals that you wanted to be accredited at the present time? And the same thing I'd like to ask about the number of people who are on antiretroviral. How many do you think, or do you know, are the latest figures, and how does that compare with your goals? And you mentioned 13 indicators that would be needed as a guideline to put people onto the therapy. How many of those would have to be present before you implemented the dual therapy? That's all.
Thank you very much. My question will be on city count. And I just want maybe the DG or Dr. Kundu, when she answers, maybe I try to make a comparison between the two pregnant women. The other one is HIV positive and her city count is at 200 or below. And this other one is HIV positive and pregnant, but her CD count is above 200. Now, I just want to know as to whether heart or how effective is the heart on this one who is HIV positive with
pregnant with above 200 CD counts. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I still want to go back to the question of policy and needs analysis. I think the Honourable Member will agree that that's a planning exercise. It's not a policy-making exercise. Let's make it a very clear distinction between the two. Policy-making and planning are two different things altogether. Now, here we have a need for us to change our policy in the country from single-dose nevirapine to dual therapy, because there's evidence in the world that this policy is actually what should be implemented in order to effect better service. Now, that's the need. The need is to ensure better results in terms of the interventions that we're making, and this is evidence-based. Now, if we are to actually have that as a policy, we have to look at the evidence that is there and whether that evidence is credible. We look at all sorts of studies and arrive at the fact that, yes, this policy is necessary for our country. So we will declare the policy because it's a necessary policy. Now, we then look at it in terms of what challenges are going to be there for implementation of that policy in order to determine how quick it can be introduced or how slowly it can be introduced. Because that now is a planning exercise for the implementation of that policy. You're not going to actually say, let's do an analysis of how many doctors we have and how many doctors we'll have in 5 years' time. That will produce, and then we'll say, on the basis of that, we'll introduce the policy in 5 years' time. When the world over is saying that the policy that you currently have is problematic, and it's going to create this problem and that other problem, and this is the evidence that is there. So that's why I'm saying you cannot really base policy making simply on a kind of planning exercise. You base it on all sorts of other frameworks that are there. So that I think is very, very important. Let me comment on this issue of the doctor in KZN, because I think it's an important issue. You see, the issues that are involved, first of all, that case has been dropped. Let me start there. And I do understand why people would actually say that they will want to defend the doctor for having exercised his discretion in that context, and doctors should always do that. When we were here last time, we said let those processes actually go through and let him be found guilty or innocent of any wrongdoing, because the wrongdoing may not necessarily be in the initiative that you're talking about, that he actually used his own money and all sorts of things like that. It may not be that, because there may be other issues that are related to that. If we do not have very, very clear principles of discipline in a system, then we might as well forget about the system. Because if I'm going to say, look, I will defy the policy position because I have access to other means of doing this in order to do that, there are implications. Because, okay, right now the doctor has the money to do this to this particular individual. Is that doctor then going to do it to everybody who comes? And if they aren't able to do it to everybody who comes, if those people then start taking steps against the government, because it's the government that is giving that service, it's not just one individual doctor in some corner, then what do we do? Because we have now initiated a process which is outside what we have actually done, and people have a right, therefore, to have the same treatment. So it may be that it's a very good thing, very pious for the doctor to do that kind of thing, but there are implications that run down the line. And therefore, the issue that we're dealing with is not simply the fact that the person did such a good deed. Maybe it's a good deed. But we have to look at the totality of the picture as to what are the implications. If Honorable Kabinde was lucky enough to get to that doctor, and the doctor did that. And then I come the following day because I'm told that actually in that hospital it happens, and it doesn't happen. Then what are the implications of that? Because then I also have the same right as Kabinde to actually have the same access as Kabinde. And therefore I would have to actually have that same access. So the issue, that's why we're saying let that process come out so that we know what is happening, and let the person be tasked as found guilty or not guilty. But the principle at the end of the day is if the department feels that somebody has done wrong, they must be allowed to discipline the person. The person has a right to defend themselves, and everybody else who supports them have a right to go and give evidence to support whatever action they've taken, and let due process take its course. Let's not be judgmental about the cases that we because both parties have a right here. The department has a right to actually raise concerns about it, and they must be proved wrong through the due process. And then we'll say, yeah, you were wrong, and that would be admitted. That was our position on that matter. But of course the case has been actually withdrawn, so it's now academic. Now, with regard to the comments by the MEC, again, it's a very difficult thing to actually take any comments out of context of whatever. In fact, in this meeting, Dr. Goodwill said the same thing. If you were listening very carefully, she has been arguing that because of the toxicity, she has said the same thing that the MEC said. But actually, it's a contextual issue. So, because we tend to sensationalize some of these issues, then we make them very big issues, and in fact, it's actually in the normal course of events. If the MEC was going to say, I'm not going to do this, I'm going to go against national policy because I believe this is the position, then it should be another matter. But I think this is actually the issue. I don't want to speak on behalf of the MEC. I don't know what was said in that context. All I'm saying is these issues are raised in any case by anybody, even people who actually are in this field. We'll talk about the challenges that we face in this area. They may be talking about them in a different way, you know, in different ways of approaches. So it's a question of approach as to how this matter is being presented. But if you say to me that the province of KwaZulu-Natal is not implementing this because the MEC says ABCD, then I would say that the minister has the responsibility to say, here's national policy, you're not implementing. Whatever debate is there, I think that people have their views, they must continue to express their views and express them responsibly, at all times. We shouldn't stop them from expressing their views responsibly. But the policy of this government is what we are adopting and will implement it, even in KwaZulu-Natal for that matter. So that's what I would want to emphasize. Perhaps the final question I want to comment on is the question. I think we have to accept, and we have accepted, I think, several times, even in this committee, but elsewhere, that the challenges of our health system are very huge, and they are growing. Because we have challenges of a changing nature of the burden of disease in this country, and therefore that has an impact on the health system. As you improve it, you find that the challenges that it is dealing with are actually also getting larger and larger, you know, and therefore we should start from the premise that we are faced with a challenge, but we also must say, what are we doing about that challenge? And yes, individual cases we've seen cases of neglect in various institutions, cases of unprofessional conduct by the professionals there. We deal with those cases when it's necessary. But where there are issues where we have challenges like issues of access because of transport problems, again we must put plans in place to see how we deal with them. Because they will be there. These are challenges that are real. We can't deny that we have the challenges that have been outlined by the Honorable Member. But what's important about this is, what are we all as a collective doing about those challenges? Because some of them could actually be dealt with even at the community level. The challenge that we're talking about of the fact that we had a child who actually couldn't be assisted in a hospital because no one actually, they said there is a shortage of midwives. I would have thought that first if it's the negligence of the hospital because somebody, then we must deal with that case. That's why in the last meeting we said, please give us the details. But if at all there was a real challenge in relation to that because of the challenges of the human resources that are there, then the next step is for us to say, how do we help that community to actually develop the necessary para skills to be able to assist those while we develop the larger skills that are there? And that's something that we must do collectively rather than say, we have these challenges. What are you doing about them? We have these challenges. What are you doing about them? All of us have the same kind of challenge because we live in this community. And of course, national will come in and say, look, you are neglecting your duty here and therefore you must do 1, 2, 3. And I think members of parliament have a duty to point out to ask those gaps. And that is why we're challenging the honorable member to give us the specifics. I think we still have that one of the last hospital. I think we must have got information in our working. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair and honorable members. Maybe just to let on that point again of toxicity. I think right through our history with ARVs, there's always been talk of resistance and toxicity, etc. These are real scientific issues around these. And one of the things that Dr. Kombi mentioned was the issue of pharmacovigilance and surveillance, resistance surveillance. Now, you will know that one of the weakest areas in the last program of PMCCT was pharmacovigilance. There are only 3 units of pharmacovigilance units in the country, and none of them are working optimally. So the issue of whether AZT is toxic or not toxic is neither here nor there until and unless we do our pharmacovigilance adequately to see exactly the level of that toxicity and the level of adverse events. So this will live with us. It will always be there. It is true that scientifically it is. But as the VG says, there's a policy position and then the individual training within that policy. So that is why in this program now we are emphasizing that the national department, government, we have to put money to make sure that we have credible data regarding adverse events and regarding resistance of some of them, so that if anything can be done, we do have the data to support whatever policy position we take after this. So while it may have happened in KZN that somebody mentioned the toxicity, yes, it's true, toxicity, but for now the policy is that we will give it, and then once we have done what needs to be done scientifically, then maybe the policy position may change. Maybe it will stay the same because there's no alternative. But I just want to emphasize that we are not oblivious to the fact that there are other issues, and we are trying to deal with them in a systematic manner. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Chair. If I may go back to the question that Honorable Ngabinde raised on testing, whether it's going to be compulsory or not, and Chair interpreted the question. Along the guideline, various points for opportunities for people to reconsider taking the test. One, initially if they have refused, but also if they were found on the first test to be negative. We're saying specifically in the policy that at every visit, this decision should be reconsidered and people encouraged to consider testing. But also specifically what we're saying, we should consider a retest at 34 weeks, specifically to address the question of efficiency or efficacy of AZT. Because you would need the 4 weeks before delivery for it to be effective. So opportunities, Chairperson, along the way are provided for people to reconsider taking the test, but if they were negative, to retest at about 34 weeks. But we also are saying just after labor, because the same opportunity to give what is called post-exposure prophylaxis to the baby. So after the delivery of the baby, the woman is given another opportunity to get to know her HIV status. It was unknown before the delivery of the baby and tested and found to be positive after delivery. Then an opportunity is made for the baby to get AZT and single dose nevirapine to reduce the risk of transmission in that particular case. So along the way in the protocol, those opportunities are made available. By the way, the professor, Honorable Dr. Rabinovitz, who did the work on infant feeding was Professor Nigel Rawlings in KZN. And there's a lot of interesting evidence that came out of that is currently being validated. On the question of, and Gigi has addressed this systemic problem with the health system. And this protocol that looks like state of the art, I wouldn't agree with the view that says this is a specialized unit that we're setting up. We're simply enhancing an already existing program and adding elements that may perhaps be complex, which is why we're saying don't simply do it while you're doing it. Do it in facilities that have these other elements to implement it. We're not innovating a new kind of sort of program. And in doing so, make sure you integrate as much as possible to other related activities, especially those that relate to caring for pregnant women, family planning, so integrate as much as possible so that you utilize more efficiently the current existing system with all the challenges that it has. As to the 7-day training program, there is, honorable member, I'm afraid no other way of getting the skill and knowledge across for people to implement the quality and adhere to the standard that has been outlined. This is not the first approach in terms of training or implementing any policy. We do it all the time, and it's part of really making sure that we provide good quality service according to the outlined standards as they are in policy. The issues that were raised by Honorable Mansa on slide 10 and slide 14 would need to be addressed. Chairperson, slide 10 specifically, perhaps Honorable Member, what that says is it's not exactly in place, but it's a recommended requirement. We're not saying these things are in place. We're saying to the provinces, please try by all means to make sure these and other things are in place. Because of our experience implementing the previous PMTCT program as well as the comprehensive plan, and strengthen the system, working with communities to make sure that this tracking system is in place. So it's a thing that says work towards that, and there should be indications that the district managers are working indeed towards making this tracking programs work and be efficient. Regarding slide 14, where we're saying small clinics should be doing A, B, C, and D, I need to indicate to the committee that the PMTC program is available in small clinics, implementing all of these elements. They're already in place at about 3,300 primary healthcare facilities in the country. All of these elements are being implemented. So we're saying continue to do that, but identify those that can provide this additional element according to supportive legislation. The other one, a chairperson that I would need to respond to, is the question of stipends. When we costed this guideline, the stipends for community caregivers, for counseling and so on, was one of the items that we put into the cost. So specifically for this one, it is covered. But we would need to be sensitive in ensuring that it's uniform and it's aligned with what else happens in the broader HIV and AIDS program and other programs for that matter, job supporters, home birth attendants and all of those. And that is done largely through the expanded public works program. It's the contribution of the social cluster towards the expanded public works program. But even linked to that, we shouldn't just end there. We should make sure that the career path for people, so they don't end up being counselors and so on. The people that are in the room that you correctly referred to should end up being nurses and doctors for that matter. So if that program should consider that as I say, that element is part of the costing of this particular guideline covered. Honourable Chairperson, DG has responded to some of the systems issues that have been raised, but there are specific technical questions around resistance development that Honourable Dr. Rabinovich has raised. I can't remember, Chairperson, how the question was raised, but I'll respond by saying there is what is called primary resistance and secondary resistance. Or the question was, is this resistance in the individual or in the community? We are worried about resistance because the community may get a previously HIV negative person may get primary resistant HIV if they have never been exposed to ARVs previously. Secondary resistance is the one that you would get from previous exposure to ARVs, which is what we're anxious about, especially with single dose nevirapine, which is why this is one of the reasons we're adding AZT to it. Now, the National Health Laboratory Services has been doing surveillance on the problem of resistance in the country. We're encouraged with the report that comes out of there that says the country has not reached the 5% threshold of the World Health Organization in terms of the problem with resistance, be it primary or secondary. What they are finding also is that most of whatever resistance is seen is coming from the private sector, and largely because of the absence in that particular sector of this community-based adherence support services, which we would need to work around with. So even as you look at the comprehensive plan that we're now 4 years down the line implementing, most of the people that have been started on the first line regimen are still on the first line regimen, which means they have not developed resistance. They're still responding well to that first line therapy. And that, together with what we are finding from National Health Laboratory Services, indicates to us that our program in terms of resistance is not doing badly. The challenge is, though, to sustain that, as you might well know. It's a long-term, lifelong commitment, and we need to make sure that the problems don't arise along the way down the line. You asked, Honorable Dr. Rabinovich, about numbers on ARVs. We do have a sense of enrolled people, but we also do have a sense of what the current numbers are, and if you will find that in the recent UNGAS report that we're sending to the UN, it will be posted on the departmental website soon. What we're finding is that retention rates on the program are quite high, as I have indicated. Perhaps by the end of September 2007, they have been in the public health sector about 350 enrolled in the public health sector. We think that outside of the public health sector, in the NGO sector, in the private sector, there's another 100,000 people enrolled on ARVs. What we're finding, though, and here I have to indicate that data is not good because of the systemic problems that have been referred to earlier. In terms of the current numbers of people, we know the enrolled, but who is still on the ARVs? Maybe I should say we don't know, but the sense that we have is that decreases by quite some margin for various reasons. And there's a midterm review currently underway for the comprehensive plan to establish what those issues are, what happens between the time that people are enrolled and at the point that you are measuring the numbers of people currently on treatment. Taking indicators, present and previously seven, These are indicators to monitor a program that has been started. It's not a condition that needs to be in place. What perhaps is a condition that needs to be in place, a requirement, is what Honorable Mazamisa has referred to earlier, that we say, look at this criteria so before you decide where you put the service. And I may indicate, Chair, to the members of the committee, that the plan is not to go the route of accreditation that we took for the comprehensive plan, because there's a program in place which is implemented to the best of what the system can provide. But we're adding an element to that program but considering that it can't simply be taken to where the current program is now. And I've outlined what the approach to that is going to be. And then Honorable Matsumela is asking about CD4 count, pregnant women positive 200, pregnant women positive more than 200. And the question relates to whether HART would be effective in the women positive more than 200. What we need to consider here, there are two things that we're trying to do. We're trying to manage the woman's HIV disease, but also we're trying in this particular case to reduce the risk of transmission in the PMTCT environment. For those women who have a CD4 count more than 200, the policy recommends that they be considered, especially for dual therapy, to reduce the risk of transmission. But closely monitor CD4 count so that you identify the point where they would be eligible for HART for their own treatment. That is the approach that we are taking, and I'm hoping that I'm responding to the question. For women who have a CD4 count of 200 and below, we are working closely with CCMT facilities to make sure that they are considered in front, if I may put it like that, in front of the queue for their own treatment. We should be treatment for their own HIV, but also to reduce transmission in terms of pregnancy, labor, and delivery, and breastfeeding, and so on. So that is the approach to the CD4 question.
For a follow-up, Chair, because there's one thing I didn't understand, and I'd appreciate if you could clarify. You said you're not going the way of accreditation, but the site would have to be approved. So there's a fine difference. How will they be approved? Will somebody sign a paper and say this site is okay? And who is it that will sign that paper? And then you didn't answer my other question, which was, how many facilities are accredited, hospitals and clinics? Do you know that figure, and how does that compare with your target? And you said there are 350,000 people publicly enrolled, 100,000 outside. What are the targets for now? And do we know how many people are on waiting list to get treatment? And, that's basically what I wanted to ask.
I
Thank you, Chairperson. On the question of accreditation, the definition that I use for accreditation is approach that we took with the comprehensive plan, which said, in the initial introduction of the comprehensive plan with all of the complex elements, provinces would identify facilities where they consider to start. There was a checklist of about 30 or so items that needed to be in place in the hospital before you started the program. Is there laboratory services? What are the opening times? Access to trauma and access to a specialist and all of these others, if I may mention a few. So there was this checklist that we used. A team from the National Department of Health would go to a province with the provincial staff to look at the facility, tick against those requirements in terms of what needs to be in place to implement the comprehensive plan, say you have these and you don't have these, speak with the province, develop a strengthening plan, that's what we called it, a strengthening plan for those facilities. Leave it with the provinces, you leave with the provinces to implement the strengthening plan. Then they would say at a point where they said, we now have all of these things in place, NASA can now come and convince itself, satisfy itself that this service will be of the quality that is expected because all of these things are in place. And then at that point, you would tick together with the province to say they have implemented the strengthening plan as agreed. They are ready now to implement the program. What I'm saying is about this particular one, we won't be taking that particular approach largely because it's already there. All of these elements in the small clinics are being implemented. They wouldn't need to be accredited in that particular session. But what we would need to make sure we do is this additional, more complex element perhaps would need to be implemented in a sub-district-based kind of approach, ensuring that the referral systems are working. until that development, it's different to implement AZT 28 days if you compare doing that with the single dose nevirapine approach to it. So that is the difference that I make between the accreditation for comprehensive plan and the approach we're taking implementing this. And we are relying basically on district managers who fully understand what happens there to identify, guided by these criteria we have outlined there, to identify those facilities that will be able to implement all the different elements of the program. In terms of the numbers of facilities that have been accredited in the comprehensive plan, Chair, it will take another day to report back on the comprehensive plan. I don't know that committee would like to go that route, but maybe I should just indicate, as I said earlier, there is about, at this point, 380 facilities that have been accredited in the fashion of the comprehensive plan, and I currently don't have the background by province as to how many are in which particular province. As I indicated earlier, there will be a midterm review to look at all of those elements as we originally conceptualized how a comprehensive plan should be done. How is the health system responding? What are the challenges? What are the things that would need to be adapted here and there? So that kind of work is currently underway. So in this particular case, we see a situation, Chair, where the district manager will advise the province, informed by the guidance here, as to which facilities in a sub-district will work in a particular complex with the referral system as outlined. And that then will input into the provincial plan the bottom-up approach that I defined sort of earlier to it. So we'll be relying mainly on the district managers to give that kind of guidance. Chair Astor.
Thank you very much, Ms. Matau, Dr. Kundu, and DG in absentia. I think once again, as all of us were saying, for a very excellent submission, we really want to congratulate yourselves. I think you did as proud you did for this submission. However, members, I'm sure all of us have been listening to a number of issues that are going to be on our left. The business plan, the time frame for training, the dates that have been set with the provinces, the budget issues that are going to be coming. At any rate, we're still going to deal with the department in terms of the budget and their business plans. We're still going to deal with the provinces, but we'll have to use some of the information here to measure whether indeed people are meeting the target as indicated, and what then will be the challenges that are there. And is requested as well by the submission here that we ourselves should be the ambassadors for the efficient implementation of this particular program. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something we ourselves must look into quite seriously. But and therefore we must isolate those areas, and fortunately they are well articulated, I think, in the submission here. May we really thank you once again, Dr. Kundu, and your team for the submission. I think all of us want to thank you and the department for the submission. And I think the minister in her absentia was here with us last time when we agreed for the revisitation of this particular presentation. We end here, am I right? Want to?
Yes, Chair, please. Just to make an appeal, and thank you, Chair, for allowing me this. And honorable members, all I wanted to say was that the department has taken this massive challenge. Massive in terms of resource requirements, and by resource requirements, I'm not necessarily only referring to the money, to the funding, but also in terms of everything else, every resource that is possible to make this. And we've been driven by the belief that if maybe we can do this, we can improve this transmission. And obviously, we've talked a lot for the last 2 hours about the challenges that the department, the government has, but specifically the department has, and we have tried to elaborate on how we intend to deal with this. However, there is still a challenge that's, which is the subject of what I make the point I want to make. The challenge the major challenge around us is still going to be a mother and a baby in the local setting. It will be such a pity for a baby to escape infection at a time when they are most vulnerable, that is during labor and during birth. All the signs that can be provided will be provided to make sure they don't get infected. But the challenge actually is what happens at home when the mother has made a choice either to breastfeed or not to breastfeed. And there I would like to appeal to all of us to lend our support. If we can save the baby at hospital, can we guarantee that that baby is safe for good? And usually the infection rate outside the hospital, that's where a lot of babies have been infected. I would really like to appeal to all of us to forget about the stipends for now, but do our bit where we can to make sure to support mothers who have made certain decisions, to stick by those decisions, just to make sure that the thrust of the implementation of the plan is successful. Thanks very much.
Honorable members, we will be having a bill in front of us here, the Tobacco Product Control Amendment Bill, that has been referred. It's still coming to ourselves, and I think there are going to be deadlines that are going to be coming. We'll be sending the notification to yourselves. You will recall last time we actually indicated the number of the bills. I suppose this bill was not in front of us, and was just said because for some reasons, again, I think something we're going to interact with the department, because sometimes the way they actually relate with us in terms of these bills is not really satisfactory. It's something we'll have to also to look into. We'll also have to satisfy in that presentation Ms. Masao, Dr. Kundu, I know that's not your, both of you, your land function, whether indeed the stakeholders have been consulted in the required time frames before this bill comes in. So we don't want to be landed with problems in the ensuing processes that we'll be dealing with. We shall program ourselves maybe in the coming week to start the process of the such bill. But I think if we can be satisfied with the information, otherwise we don't want to come back and deal with the termination of pregnancy after all the processes have dealt with. Thank you very much. I'm sure there's lunch at C10, which is a restaurant just around the corner here. Well, we are invited to lunch. Thank you very much.